Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. This podcast is also sponsored by DocketWise, an all-in-one immigration forms and case management solution trusted by thousands of immigration lawyers across the U.S. I really like DocketWise. It makes immigration applications easy by allowing the clients to provide information through simple online questionnaires that are shareable by text or email and available in multiple languages. Not only that, DocketWise provides a comprehensive group of case management features, including invoicing and calendaring, secure messaging, task management, and a lot more. You can learn all about DocketWise and receive a 10% discount on your subscription by heading to docketwise.com/immigration-review, so they know we sent you. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. Four fascinating factual cases this week, with lots of cat deferral. Weird. My sacrifice to the immigration gods last week seems to have paid dividends. Thank you to everyone who wrote congratulating me on my move and wishing me well. And that includes you, my friend and colleague who happens to be a longtime USCIS employee, who wrote to additionally let me know that contrary to what I said in one of those many cases last week, the good moral character catch-all provision at INA Section 101F did not originate with IRIRA, but is instead much older. That's an important correction, and I appreciate it very much. On to the strange. Starting off, we have Tinoco Acevedo v. Garland, published by the Fourth Circuit on August 11th, 2022. Back-to-back weeks starting off with the fourth? I had no choice. This case is about immigration judge conduct and matter of YSLC. And it's not the type of decision that one wants to be on the other side of. Mr. Tinoco Acevedo is from Nicaragua and became a lawful permanent resident in 2008. He traveled to Nicaragua to visit his family, as is his right, but upon his return in 2019, he was not simply let into the U.S., as LPRs are supposed to be. Rather, he was placed in removal proceedings, charged as being inadmissible. As we often discuss, LPRs can only be removed under the provisions outlined in INA Section 237. And when they depart the U.S. and re-enter, they're supposed to be let in similarly to how U.S. citizens are. That is, unless they've done something that makes them fall within one of the definitions at INA Section 101A13C. That is certainly not applicable to U.S. citizens. If the LPR does something to fall under that statute, the LPR is viewed similarly to someone without a legal right to be in the U.S. and must overcome the grounds of inadmissibility at INA Section 212 in removal proceedings, rather than the generally more non-citizen favorable provisions at INA Section 237. And that's what happened here. Because Mr. Tinoco Acevedo has three DUI convictions and a conviction for, quote, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, end quote, resulting in an aggregate prison sentence of over 5 years across all crimes. Unsure if he actually served that time, but immigration law doesn't really care. Big problem because under INA Section 212A2B, a non-citizen is inadmissible, quote, when he has been convicted of criminal offenses for which the aggregate sentence equals 5 years or more. To make the non-citizen inadmissible, those convictions need not be CIMTs, as would be the case under INA Section 237 to remove an LPR. Any conviction will do to make the non-citizen inadmissible if the 5-year sentence is present and they are properly charged as inadmissible. To wrap up this thread, and while undiscussed in this decision, Mr. Tinoco Acevedo was properly charged as inadmissible under INA Section 212 rather than as a removable LPR under Section 237, because INA Section 101A13CV permits DHS to charge LPRs returning from abroad as inadmissible if they have, quote, committed an offense identified at INA Section 212A2, end quote. So the whole thing, charging the LPR as inadmissible and succeeding on that inadmissibility charge, is pretty circular. Also remember, DHS could not have charged Mr. Tinoco Acevedo like this if he had never left the U.S. Indeed, DHS tried in 2009 by attempting to show that that delinquency of a minor conviction was a CIMT, but DHS failed. Had Mr. Tinoco Acevedo not left the country and stayed on the straight and narrow for like a decade, he probably could have naturalized relatively easily, eventually. Anyway, Mr. Tinoco Acevedo did leave, and he did concede that he was removable as charged under Section 212, and he applied for LPR cancellation of removal under INA Section 240A-A. Essentially, a second chance to keep his green card. Mr. Tinoco Acevedo satisfied all the elements to get that relief, but the IJ and the BIA denied as a matter of discretion. Most prominently, the IJ relied upon a police report of that delinquency conviction showing that Mr. Tinoco Acevedo was charged with exposing himself to a child. But the police report wasn't part of the record. DHS never submitted it. It was, however, part of those first removal proceedings, which the IJ reviewed prior to issuing the decision denying relief, but did not make part of the record at the individual hearing or thereafter. Somewhat unrelated, Mr. Tinoco Acevedo's attorney tried to show that Mr. Tinoco Acevedo would have a rough time if he was removed to Nicaragua because he didn't speak fluent Spanish anymore. In response, the IJ said a few things, including, and of course this is only a partial transcript, quote, "It sounds so stupid, honest to God," end quote, in regards to the attorney's questioning on this issue. And then the IJ told Mr. Tinoco Acevedo himself, quote, "You're claiming that at 38 you can only function at 60% in Spanish? Because I really find that so incredible. It's laughable," end quote. The Fourth Circuit remanded, agreeing with Mr. Tinoco Acevedo that the BIA had failed to consider Mr. Tinoco Acevedo's argument that the presiding IJ had not, quote, "satisfied the high standards expected of IJs under matter of YSLC," end quote. Say what? Important to this case, in matter of YSLC, the BIA made clear that, quote, "a respondent in immigration proceedings should expect dignity, respect, courtesy, and fairness in a hearing before an IJ," end quote. The BIA went on to hold that IJs must not behave in a manner that, quote, "creates the appearance that an IJ has abandoned his or her role as a neutral fact finder and raises a question whether the respondent was given a full and fair hearing of his claims and a reasonable opportunity to present evidence on his behalf," end quote. As in matter of YSLC itself, the belittling of a respondent might violate this standard and might require remand by the BIA, quote, "without discussing the IJ's decision denying relief on the merits," end quote. That is, remand might be required even if there is no error in the substance of the IJ's decision. Now that's a powerful case. Oyl argued here that matter of YSLC merely describes a due process standard, which would then require a prejudice showing to result in a remand, but the Fourth Circuit did not agree. The BIA in matter of YSLC didn't require a showing that the respondent would have won. The IJ's adverse conduct alone was sufficient. In so holding and so reading matter of YSLC like this, the Fourth Circuit breaks new ground. So remand is required, because the BIA in no way discussed whether remand and a transfer to a new immigration judge was required in light of matter of YSLC, as a result of some of those comments from the IJ that would appear to belittle Mr. Tinoco Acevedo for his lack of ability to speak Spanish fluently and the belittling of the attorney for bringing up that line of questioning. And additionally, maybe for relying on that police report that was not actually part of the record. Congratulations, Petition for Review Counsel Ben Winograd, for petitioner. Awesome advocacy. And check out these footnotes. In a footnote, the Fourth Circuit implies that maybe the case should be reassigned to a new IJ if it is remanded by the BIA. And in another footnote, due to what is simply a disaster for EOIR, the Fourth Circuit references an EOIR attorney advisor by name, because the attorney advisor's memorandum to the immigration judge made it into the record somehow. Actually, it looks like for reasons that are completely bonkers, that attorney advisor's memorandum, quote, was attached to the IJ's written decision, end quote. In that memo, the attorney advisor appears to be saying that the IJ's instructions to deny are being followed, despite Mr. Tinoco Acevedo's, quote, genuine rehabilitation, end quote. I believe I speak for former and current attorney advisors everywhere when I say, my God. But also, no publicity is bad publicity, so they say. And that is Tinoco Acevedo v. Garland. There you have it, your non-citizen win for the week. Next is KY v. U.S. Attorney General, published by the 11th Circuit on August 9th, 2022. This case is about particularly serious crimes and cat deferral. Quote, KY is a transgender woman who has been living in the United States as a lawful permanent resident since January 23rd, 2011, end quote. She is from Guyana, a country on the northern coast of South America. While in Guyana, Ms. KY identified as a gay man, but kept that identity secret because, quote, homosexuality is condemned in Guyana, end quote. She began living openly as a transgender woman in the U.S. in 2015. But in early 2015, quote, Ms. KY sought sexually explicit images, discussed performing different sex acts, and arranged a meeting with an undercover police officer pretending to be a 15-year-old boy, end quote. She eventually pled nulla contendere to, quote, 1. Traveling to meet a minor in violation of Florida Statute Section 247.01354A, and 2. Soliciting a child for unlawful sexual conduct using computer services or devices in violation of Florida Statute Section 847.01353A, end quote. She received just under 4 years imprisonment, 10 years probation, and had to register as a sex offender. DHS sought her removal under INA Section 237A2AI as a non-citizen convicted of a crime involving moral turpitude within 5 years of admission. Her conviction might match a few more removability provisions, but maybe DHS believed that this one was the easiest to satisfy. I don't know. Ms. KY conceded removability and applied for asylum and related relief. At the final hearing, the immigration judge found both Ms. KY and her expert credible, but found that her crime was a particularly serious crime under the matter of NAM analysis, such that she could only apply for Convention Against Torture deferral. Now apparently, quote, Ms. KY was never the victim of any physical violence while she lived in Guyana, end quote, but she did witness some violent things occur to similar individuals. Her expert testified and supported her well-founded fear. The IJ found Ms. KY had not met her burden, and the BIA affirmed that decision. Ms. KY brought three arguments to the 11th Circuit, but the 11th Circuit rejected them. First, on cat deferral, the 11th Circuit affirmed the denial. To succeed in the 11th Circuit, quote, the evidence must demonstrate that the applicant will be specifically and individually targeted for torture, end quote. Emphasis from the court. And unmet here to the 11th Circuit, as the evidence was of discrimination, quote, and even physical violence against the LGBT population, end quote, generally. Ms. KY hadn't pointed to anything specific to her. That's going to be a difficult standard to meet, particularly here as Ms. KY had in fact been personally extorted by police in Guyana, seemingly because of her sexuality, but that didn't count to the court, as it, quote, is not the same as torture, end quote. Plus, to the court, the evidence didn't show that the Guyanese government would acquiesce to the torture, as the cat requires. Because, quote, the Guyanese government has taken steps in recent years to improve country conditions for the LGBT population in Guyana, including hosting a gay pride parade and allowing a number of active LGBT advocacy organizations to operate freely, end quote. This finding was affirmed despite laws on the books criminalizing same-sex actions. And that's because, quote, the immigration judge found that the country conditions evidence indicated that the police did not enforce the laws criminalizing same-sex relations except to extort bribes, end quote. Ms. KY argued that the IJ did not give, quote, reasoned consideration, end quote, to her evidence, a different and possibly more non-citizen-friendly argument to make at the circuit court, as compared to arguing that the IJ's findings are not supported by substantial evidence. However, to the 11th Circuit, it couldn't review this argument because Ms. KY hadn't made it to the BIA. A fairly nuanced and strict exhaustion holding. Nevertheless, actually, though, the 11th Circuit did review the argument, in addition to the challenge that the IJ's findings were unsupported by substantial evidence. To the court, the IJ considered the claims, and the decision was supported by substantial evidence. For example, the Guyanese government had agreed to abide by a Caribbean Court of Justice's decision overturning some prohibitions on cross-dressing. Under the deferential standard of review applied in such cases, the 11th Circuit upheld the IJ and the BIA's decisions here. Addressing then the particularly serious crime finding that barred Ms. KY from asylum and withholding of removal, Ms. KY argued that a particularly serious crime finding cannot be sustained based simply on the convictions here alone. Rather, in all cases, actually, it requires a, quote, separate determination that she posed a danger to the community, end quote. After all, the particularly serious crime statute precludes asylum and withholding for, quote, a non-citizen if the Attorney General decides that the non-citizen, having been convicted by a final judgment of a particularly serious crime, is a danger to the community of the United States, end quote. Now, in matter of BZR, issued by Attorney Garland and discussed on episode 107, the Attorney General reasoned that whether a non-citizen is indeed a danger is central to the particularly serious crime analysis. But if I recall correctly, the Attorney General did not require a separate finding. Rather, according to Attorney General Garland, a conviction could indicate that a non-citizen is a danger, or conversely, a violent conviction might not indicate that a non-citizen is a danger if other factors, such as mental health concerns, indicate otherwise. As I recall the Attorney General's decision, dangerousness remains the overarching concern. Matter of VZR likely came out after oral argument in this case, and the 11th Circuit doesn't discuss it. And here too, actually, the 11th Circuit deemed this argument unexhausted, and then alternatively rejected it, citing to its prior precedent that does not require two separate findings. To the court, a conviction alone can indicate that a non-citizen is a danger and thereby constitute a particularly serious crime. Not so dissimilar to the Attorney General's recent ruling, although the Attorney General appears a bit more nuanced. Finally, Ms. KY argued that her crime actually wasn't particularly serious. Before getting to that, the 11th Circuit first determined, after a lengthy analysis filled with large words, that yes, it has jurisdiction to consider this argument, notwithstanding some recent Supreme Court rulings, as the inquiry is not a purely discretionary finding. Honestly, sometimes, I feel like these initial jurisdiction discussions are like that scene from Lord of the Rings, where the Ents spend like an hour concluding that Merry and Pippin are not orcs, on the eve of that battle with Saruman. Too nerdy? I can no longer hide my true nature. Anyway, having satisfied itself of jurisdiction in Old Entish, the 11th Circuit affirmed the IJ's particularly serious crime finding. Quote, the plain language of the statute requires a perpetrator to knowingly attempt to engage in unlawful sexual conduct or some other illegal act, like abuse with the person the perpetrator believes is a child. It is no analytical strain to conclude that this is particularly serious in several respects. End quote. For example, the 11th Circuit notes how the crime here is a crime against persons rather than property, involves a vulnerable population, and requires a knowing mental state. Plus, the harm here, sexual abuse, is serious, and Ms. KY demonstrated a pattern of multiple attempts to commit her crimes. All factors present here, and all factors rarely present elsewhere. Ms. KY was therefore deemed ineligible for asylum and withholding, and she was denied CAT deferral. And that is KY, the U.S. Attorney General. That brings us to the first of two Eighth Circuit decisions, Keta v. Garland, published by the Eighth Circuit on August 10th, 2022. This decision follows a somewhat common pattern of late, a grant of CAT deferral for a non-citizen with criminal convictions, followed by a BIA reversal, followed by a circuit court action. Mr. Keta is from Eritrea. He lived there until relocating to Ethiopia at 40 years old. He entered the U.S. as a refugee in 2007, and he became an LPR in 2009. But people aren't perfect, including refugees. Quote, in January 2019, Mr. Keta was convicted in Iowa of two offenses, domestic abuse assault with a dangerous weapon, and willful injury causing serious injury, end quote. Placed in removal proceedings, it seems like everyone agreed that those were particularly serious crimes that made Mr. Keta ineligible for everything except CAT deferral. At the hearing, Mr. Keta requested a Kunama interpreter, the language Mr. Keta spoke best and which is, quote, spoken by the Kunama people, an ethnic group native to Eritrea, end quote. Unable to secure that unique interpreter, the IJ, quote, instead accommodated Mr. Keta's second language by securing a Chogrinya interpreter, and then took steps to ensure that Mr. Keta understood the hearing. Tigrinya is a language commonly spoken in Eritrea, end quote. Then, in lieu of a direct examination, the IJ permitted Mr. Keta to submit a sworn statement. Very interesting. Explaining his escape from Eritrea, his incarceration for refusing the mandatory military service in that country, and his terrible beating and electrocution while in an Eritrean prison. Not to be outdone, DHS crossed Mr. Keta by introducing his sworn statement that he made with an asylum officer previously, which reflected that, quote, neither Mr. Keta nor his family members were harmed or threatened by anyone while in Eritrea, end quote. And that he had fled Eritrea because the government took his land. Quote, the IJ concluded that Mr. Keta's testimony, although he didn't testify, right, was not credible, but that he was nonetheless entitled to deferral of removal under the Convention Against Torture, end quote. I knew it was possible, but I've never actually seen it happen in one of these decisions. Rejoice! The IJ granted CAT deferral notwithstanding the adverse credibility finding because, reviewing country condition evidence including from the, quote, European Asylum Support Office, end quote, the IJ determined, and this is paraphrasing here, that deportees to Eritrea were imprisoned and tortured. Like I said, the BIA reversed, and the Eighth Circuit upheld the BIA. As an initial matter, the Eighth Circuit upheld the IJ's adverse credibility finding, quote, the immigration judge reasonably concluded that Mr. Keta's failure to mention significant facts about alleged imprisonment and torture to the asylum officer undermined the credibility of his later claim at the immigration hearing, end quote. Nor did the Eighth Circuit see a due process violation in the denial of a Kunama interpreter. The IJ, quote, took a number of steps to ensure that Mr. Keta could participate adequately in the hearing, end quote, including providing, quote, the interpreter and Mr. Keta an opportunity to speak off the record to determine whether they could understand each other, end quote. Mr. Keta repeatedly affirmed that he could understand the interpreter, and the IJ permitted Mr. Keta several opportunities to have issues and statements clarified. And then Mr. Keta replied at the end of the hearing that he understood everything. Due process had been assured to the Eighth Circuit because Mr. Keta was provided a sufficient ability to participate in his hearing. Nor did a due process violation occur through DHS's introduction for impeachment of that asylum interview statement because, citing to the IJ practice manual, as I like to do as well, quote, a document used for impeachment need not be made available to the non-citizen before the hearing under the immigration court's procedures, end quote. That's also the case under the Federal Rules of Evidence, I believe. Left then with the substance of the BIA's denial of deferral of removal, the Eighth Circuit affirmed that the BIA did apply the correct clear error standard, and then the Eighth Circuit upheld those findings. For example, quote, the article on which the IJ relied expressly acknowledged that the fate of most returnees to Eritrea is unknown. Only cases of returnees from across the land border with Sudan were documented, end quote. Didn't meet the high CAT standard, according to the BIA and the Eighth Circuit. And so, Mr. Keta lost his case. And that is Keta v. Garland. That leaves us with Muhammad v. Garland, published by the Eighth Circuit on August 10th, 2022. This one's on a lot of stuff, including withholding of removal. Mr. Muhammad is from Somalia and entered the U.S. as a refugee, as a child, in 1996. He He became a LPR and his parents naturalized, and he himself applied to naturalize, but, quote, his application was denied due to a returned check for the processing fees, end quote. And that was never rectified. It's going to get a lot more complicated, but if I'm being direct here, Mr. Muhammad is really being ordered deported because his check was returned by USCIS many years ago. If it hadn't been, he'd be a citizen, and this decision wouldn't exist. As an adult, Mr. Muhammad was arrested and convicted in federal court for the possession of khat, a drug that I believe is legal in many parts of the world, but which is illegal federally and in most, if not all, states. DHS therefore initiated removal proceedings against Mr. Muhammad in 2011. After all, he never naturalized. With removal proceedings pending, Mr. Muhammad was convicted of two counts of insurance fraud in Minnesota in 2017. That led to additional charges of removability. In defense, he applied for asylum and related relief, attesting to having suffered violence in 1999 based on his membership in a minority clan in Somalia, and that additionally in the future, if returned, he'd be targeted by Al-Shabaab as a, quote, musician who dances with naked women and who does not share their Islamic ideologies, end quote. Mr. Muhammad also applied for LPR cancellation of removal under INA Section 240AA, which the IJ granted. There was a lot going on here before the IJ that I'll get into in a bit. And in the alternative, the IJ granted Mr. Muhammad's application for asylum, and then alternative to that, withholding of removal. Quote, based on potential membership of Somalis in the United States who have produced music videos involving partially clothed women, end quote. DHS appealed it all and got its reversal on all of it. Quote, the BIA reversed the IJ's grant of cancellation of removal, finding the IJ incorrectly weighed the adverse nature of Mr. Muhammad's lengthy criminal history and gave too much weight to his equities, end quote. In addition to the criminal history, which included lots of arrests in addition to convictions, Mr. Muhammad, quote, had a spotty work history, minimally supported his five U.S. citizen children, and his own needs were being met by his family, end quote. The life of a musician. On asylum, the BIA agreed with DHS that the particular social group was not socially distinct. And additionally, that, quote, the IJ further erred by not considering DHS's rebuttal evidence showing that Benandiri and Rir Hamar clan members can safely relocate to Mogadishu and are rarely targeted by other clans, end quote. On remand, the IJ denied cancellation, asylum, and cat protection, but again granted withholding of removal, which is not discretionary, based on Mr. Muhammad's religion-based claim, but not based on clan membership. Specifically, and as one example, quote, the IJ pointed to the testimony from Mr. Muhammad and several witnesses regarding Mr. Muhammad's music video posted on the internet showing Mr. Muhammad dancing with a woman not fully clothed, which drew sharp criticism and online threats, end quote. DHS appealed, and the BIA reversed the IJ again, holding that, quote, DHS had not been given a full and fair opportunity to rebut the IJ's findings regarding a religion-based claim, end quote. The BIA did, however, affirm the part that the IJ denied, relief based on clan membership. The BIA remanded for the IJ to further explain the religion-based grant, and for DHS to have another opportunity to present rebuttal evidence, and for the IJ to further explain the finding that Mr. Muhammad didn't warrant discretionary relief like cancellation and asylum. Quote, on remand, the case was assigned to a different IJ because the initial IJ had retired, end quote. Before the new IJ, and notwithstanding DHS's new opportunity provided to it by the BIA, quote, no additional testimony was presented by either party, end quote. On the same record that existed before the previous IJ, the new IJ denied everything. This time, Mr. Muhammad appealed, and this time, the BIA affirmed the IJ. And to the Eighth Circuit it went. In this decision, the Eighth Circuit noted in a footnote, quote, DHS counsel's lack of candor, end quote, in its second appeal arguments to the BIA. But it affirmed the BIA's third decision, denying everything. And it was a rough posture before the Eighth Circuit, because due to the criminal convictions, INA Section 242A2C stripped the court of jurisdiction to review purely factual disputes. The Supreme Court's Gorrell-Asprilla decision provides a jurisdiction to review mixed questions of law and fact, even for non-citizens with criminal convictions, but pure factual disputes are out. In any event, the Eighth Circuit saw nothing wrong with the BIA's second reversal. One of the main challenges Mr. Muhammad brought here. For example, the Eighth Circuit agreed that Mr. Muhammad may not have sufficiently raised a religion claim before the IJ the first time, such that DHS had an opportunity to combat it. Nor does Mr. Muhammad having provided credible testimony necessarily mean that he must succeed on his withholding of removal claim. Particularly where, apparently here with the threats stemming from the music videos, the testimony is largely uncorroborated. Mr. Muhammad never was able to show proof of the threats that he received from the music video. According to him, he had technical difficulties and so could not produce it to the court. At the end of the day, and quote, despite the party's lack of diligence, the record supports the final decisions by the IJ and BIA that Mr. Muhammad failed to satisfy his burden of showing a particularized threat of persecution, rendering him ineligible for asylum and likewise withholding of removal, end quote. Mr. Muhammad's saga comes to an end. Here's some weird legal stuff to conclude the episode. In deciding this case, the Eighth Circuit addressed some other issues that are often confusing and complicated in immigration court. For example, the Eighth Circuit held that, quote, collateral estoppel is inapplicable because all decisions at issue here were made at different stages of the same action, end quote. That is, until there's a final order of removal, the doctrine of collateral estoppel can't even potentially apply in immigration proceedings, according to the Eighth Circuit. Relatedly, quote, application of the law of the case doctrine is discretionary in immigration proceedings. And unless the BIA qualifies or limits the remand to a specific purpose, we will not find an abuse of discretion when an IJ reconsiders a prior determination on an issue, end quote. That's an interesting quote with a whole lot going on, with some non-citizen-friendly applications depending on the posture of the case. So I thought I'd share it. That's what I'd do. And that is Muhammad v. Garland. So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate for 5 credit hours, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all. And follow the show on Instagram and Facebook at Immigration Review and send us a tweet at ImReview. That's I-M-M Review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.